And maybe we can give him, since he can only attend the first half, the most detailed science ones. Those are his area of expertise.
Okay, I will root through here for just another moment and see if I can pick those out first.
Okay, but we're both good with any of them. So if that's too much, don't worry about it.
And Dr. Zink, this is Erin from Petersburg/Wrangell Public Health, and I'm also on the line if you need me to answer any questions for like contact tracing or whatnot. I'm available too.
Perfect. I was just scrolling through the names and the faces, and one, getting to see new faces I've never met before, and two, seeing if I recognize any other names on here. So thank you. It's kind of like traveling around the state every evening on some other Zoom call. I get to see like everyone's houses and cats and dogs and family members. So it's an honor to be here.
And this is Dr. Joe McLaughlin. I'm on as well.
Thanks, Joe.
And it's Dr. Przonka. I'm actually under Steve Przonka as we're sharing one Zoom video window here. So I'm on as well from Wrangell Medical Center and Search.
Great. Thank you so much for being on. I recognize the name now that you say it, but didn't recognize the whole one in the Zoom. So
okay, I think since it's just after 5:30 and we have a very short time window tonight for the entire meeting and for a number of attendees, we're going to get going. I just would like to welcome everyone and say thank you very much to gathering this evening during everyone's busy time to have a conversation, a Q&A session, public meeting, town hall meeting about COVID-19 and related subjects. I'd again like to thank Dr. Ann Zink, who's the Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska, for joining us. Dr. Joe McLaughlin with State Epidemiology is also on the line this evening to answer questions. Erin Michael, who's our regional state public health nurse, is here. And I believe Representative Dan Ortez is joining us. And then Dr. Przonka, Dr. Lynn Przonka with Search Medical Center is also on the line to answer any questions. And so I, just to explain to everybody, we put the call out for questions ahead of time, and those were submitted in and compiled. And we provided those to Dr. Zink ahead of time to give her a little bit of a heads up. We will read through those prepared questions that were submitted in. If we have time, people are welcome to put a question in the chat, and Kim, our city clerk, will pull those up. And if we have an opportunity at the end of the session to go through those, we certainly will do that. But we want to respect everybody's time constraints. So with that, I will get started here on the questions. So the first is, what is the difference between the type of tests available for COVID-19?
I'm going to let you take all the first ones.
Great. Thank you so much. So, yeah, this is Dr. Joe McLaughlin, and sure, can everybody hear me okay?
Yep, we can hear that.
Okay, super. So the two main categories of tests that we look at for COVID-19 are molecular diagnostic tests, and they are used to diagnose COVID-19 in people who are currently symptomatic or asymptomatic, but they currently have infection. And then the other sort of main umbrella of tests is serologic tests. And those tests look at whether or not a person has been previously infected and now they have antibodies to the virus that causes COVID-19. So those are the two main categories of testing. And what we across the nation are using to diagnose COVID-19 is these molecular diagnostic tests. The most common one that people have heard about is the PCR test. And that PCR test is what we use at the state public health labs. We have two state public health laboratories, one up in Fairbanks, one in Anchorage. And those tests are highly reliable overall. They have a high sensitivity and a very high specificity. So I'm happy to go into more detail on testing if you'd like, but maybe I'll just leave it at that for right now.
Thank you very much. Second question, what are the this was a question by Assemblymember Julie Decker. What are the limitations of testing and why can't we rely solely on test results to understand what is happening with the virus?
Sure, thank you for that. This is Dr. Joe McLaughlin. I'll take that one as well. So in terms of the limitation of the test, so let's just take the molecular diagnostic test like the PCR test. The primary limitation of those tests is the sensitivity of the test. And the sensitivity is how reliable is that test at detecting illness in somebody who's ill, detecting infection in somebody who's actually infected. And right now the gold standard test is the PCR test. We don't know what proportion of patients who are infected that test actually misses, but it's probably a small proportion, probably less than 5%, and it may be as small as about 2 or 3%. And the specificity is a measure of if the test is negative, can you rely on that negative result? How reliable is that negative result? If it's positive, can you rely on that positive test result? And this is specificity. And fortunately, with the PCR test, the specificity is very high. It's on the order of almost 100%. So that's great. So those are two of the things that we look at in terms of the reliability of the test, the sensitivity and the specificity. When you look at the serologic test to determine whether or not a person was previously infected, we see that both the sensitivity and the specificity overall are much lower. And that's why the serologic tests are not used widely in individual patients across the country, especially in those communities in those states that have low prevalence of disease. Because if you look at the Alaska situation, you know, we're reporting just under 0.1% of the population having been infected. Now, let's just say that the true proportion of the population that's been infected is 10 times what we're currently reporting because we're only detecting 1 in 10 cases. Let's say that's the case, and I don't think it's that high. But even if you have a detection rate, a prevalence of 1%, when you've got a test that is not very reliable with respect to the specificity, you're more likely to get a false positive than you are to get a true positive. And so that's why we're not seeing a lot of serologic testing being done in Alaska at this time.
And then I just might add a couple other things to that. And that's when you get a sample in the lab. We also see that there can be a lot of problems with sample collection as well as in transport. And so there's other ways that the test may not be as sensitive. And it's also good to remember that with this virus, you see the highest viral shedding right before someone gets symptoms and early on in their disease course. And it goes down over time. And so it also depends on the timing of it. I think the other challenging thing with this disease is there's no really good clinical diagnosis. There's no way to say, you know, you've got that big red check mark on your chest, you have COVID. The symptoms are very consistent with a lot of other diseases, and that's why the test can be really useful. But that's also only a point in time to say, does that person have this virus in their nose at that time? And then we look at the tool itself to say, okay, if I got the virus on the swab, did the machine pick it up? But you got to get the virus on the swab, and that depends on both the timing, the collection, and the transport as well.
I think that's a really important point to underscore. The fact that if I'm infected and I sneeze on every one of you that's listening to me right now, some of you are going to never have any symptoms. Most of you who will develop symptoms at about 5 days after you're sneezed on. But in terms of when you'll actually trigger a positive test, it typically will take at least on the order of several days for your test to turn positive. That's because your body has to have enough virus circulating, and you need to be secreting enough virus in your nasal and respiratory secretions to trigger a positive test. And so that can take many days. So that's why people can be infected but not actually test positive, at least initially.
And that's part of the reason if someone's exposed, we don't recommend getting tested that day. And that's why we recommend that 14-day quarantine period to see if they develop symptoms, and really watch for symptoms, because right when they begin symptoms, that's when we're most likely to catch the disease, and why we recommend those two things. So it can be important, particularly for small communities like yourself. You get a positive, you know, testing everyone the next day is not going to be a very useful tool. But really doing that 14-day quarantine, watching for symptoms and testing at the moment those symptoms start is going to be the most accurate way to use that test to pick up new cases.
Okay, thank you for that. Next question, also from a community member. What can you tell us about COVID antibody immunity? This is a three-part question, or excuse me, a four-part question. Does everyone who gets COVID build antibodies? How long does it take for the antibodies to be detectable? How long does the antibody immunity last?
Great, I can go ahead and start with that. So the answer is we still don't know for sure. So we're learning a lot about COVID, and we're learning out a lot about antibody response to COVID. Some of the initial reports that have come out from serologic surveys have of people who have tested positive with a PCR test, have found that not everybody develops antibodies, at least detectable antibodies. Most seem to develop detectable antibodies, but some do not. And then some develop more than others. What we're finding is that people who have more severe illness, and even people who are older, tend to generate more antibodies than people who have milder illness. The antibodies start to come on board after about a week and a half to 2 weeks of illness. That's when you start to see antibodies go up, both IgM and IgG antibodies. The IgM is sort of the acute phase antibodies, and those tend to peak quickly and then fall off fairly quickly over the course of several weeks. And then the IgG antibodies, which are sort of more prolonged, they tend to hang out in the body for a longer period of time. Those sort of peak around the same time as the IgM, but then they fall off much more slowly, taper off much more slowly. And so people may continue to have antibodies for months to potentially years. That's something that we're still studying, and you know, we'll learn more as the months go on. But the other question is, does an antibody response mean that a person is going to be immune to the virus? And if so, for how long? The answer to that question is, or those two questions are, first of all, we don't know for sure. Based on what we know about other viruses, respiratory virus humans, is once you do generate an antibody response, in the vast majority of cases, people do have some level of immunity to prevent reinfection. And so we're assuming that's likely going to be the case for COVID-19, especially in folks who generate a good antibody response. The durability of that response, how long will people be protected? We don't know the answer to that. We know that there are four other human coronaviruses that are commonly circulating globally. And on average, for those four human coronaviruses, people tend to have immunity for about a year, plus or minus some months. And so we don't know yet how that's going to all shake out for COVID-19, but that kind of gives you a general sense for what to expect. And let me know if I missed anything.
No, I echo all those points. The only other point I might make is that there were a lot of antibody tests on the market. FDA recalled over 100 of them because a lot of them were cross-reacting with the kind of common cold. So just to be aware of that. And, you know, Joe talked a little bit earlier about kind of that pretest probability and putting that into bigger context to understand what those antibodies mean. And so from on an individual basis, we can't say at this time that if you test for COVID-19 and the antibody test, that that means you have protection. We think there's probably some degree of it, but we still ask people to use caution and ask you to do it in combination with your primary care provider, who can then go through your history and make a better kind of informed information based on that. We as a state aren't doing widespread antibody testing because it's really just more of a kind of an interesting question. It would not direct our management or change at this time. And we've looked at COVID cases around the state in all sorts of ways, everything from what we call ILI or influenza-like illness in postmortem cases. We've talked about in previous outbreaks and flu, and we see no evidence of widespread circulating COVID prior. Other states, that's not true. And like New York, they saw an increase of influenza-like illness being admitted to the hospital for some time before they started COVID cases. So we really looked around other states and looked at to see what was tracking. And I think we were fortunate that we had testing up here. So when we started to see cases, we were starting to pick them up quickly.
Okay, thank you. The next question from a community member is, what can you tell us about whether asymptomatic people can spread COVID? And maybe explain the difference between pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic, please.
Anne, would you like me to take that one?
Sure, up to you, Joe.
Okay, sure. So asymptomatic transmission is almost certainly happens. We don't know the degree to which it happens. That's something that's still being studied. I'm sure many of you have seen the report that came out suggesting that from the WHO, suggesting that asymptomatic transmission is not common. And that got a lot of critical review when that came out, especially here in the United States. And so, you know, I think we need to assume that people who are asymptomatic, who are infected, do transmit the virus based on many of the epidemiologic studies that have occurred to date. There's good evidence to indicate that that happens. The degree to which it happens is still something that we have to figure out. The difference between asymptomatic transmission and pre-symptomatic transmission is that in both cases, people don't have symptoms, but the pre-symptomatic folks are folks who are within one to two days prior to symptom onset, and maybe up to 3 days prior to symptom onset. And what we know for those people is that that's when viral shedding tends to start really peaking. We think of viral shedding as being, virus that's being shed through respiratory secretions. And it tends to peak around a day before to right on the day of symptom onset. And so if you think of a bell-shaped curve, if those are your two peak days, then you go on either side of those days and get a sense for, when viral shedding is highest. It's usually within about probably 2 to 3 days on either side of those 2 days. So hopefully that answers that question.
And then I guess I'll just add too, when we do asymptomatic testing, kind of like pre-procedural and things like that, it's surprising when you go back through the cases, a lot of people were either pre-symptomatic or very mildly symptomatic. So from a science perspective about who's asymptomatic and who's pre-symptomatic, it's an interesting question for the individual and what that means and if I should get tested or not, or do I have COVID or not. I think it actually matters less because there's so much viral spread in the pre-symptomatic and mild disease category. And that's why I think we just really need to treat everyone like they've got COVID these days.
Thank you. So the next question, I believe, is directly related to the answer that was just given, but only if viral shedding at its highest level is also the same as contagion at its highest level. So the next question is, when is a person most contagious? Are they more contagious if they have symptoms?
Yeah, great question. And people are most contagious when they're shedding the most virus. So right around that time of symptom onset. And unfortunately, that's the time when people are very mildly symptomatic. Oftentimes people will say, gosh, all I had was a sniffle or a slight cough or maybe just a low-grade fever, or maybe some muscle aches. And that's all I had for a couple of days. And then, I had other symptoms that came on 2 or 3 or 4 days later. And so unfortunately, with this virus, people are transmitting, are most infectious to other people during that pre-symptomatic period and during that early symptomatic period when their symptoms are very mild.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. So next question, actually, this is from June Leffler, who's our KSTK radio reporter. Looking beyond confirmed positive cases, does the state have estimates for how many people could be infected with coronavirus? Is there an estimate for Wrangell specifically? And I would add to her question, given the number of cases that we have, positive cases, are there extrapolations from that?
Sure, I can start with that. This is Joe McLaughlin, and maybe Ann can add to this. Again, the answer is we really don't know what proportion of cases we're missing with our surveillance system here in Alaska and nationally and globally. There have been some studies that have been done to try and estimate this in different populations. And it's important to really point out that those estimates are probably appropriate for those populations. And you really have to think about your population's unique characteristics and the testing strategy and all that kind of stuff that's employed in your population. So there was one study that was done out of China that suggested that they, for every case that they detected, this was early on in Wuhan, for every case that they had detected, there were about six cases that were undiagnosed. And, you know, when you kind of read some of the academic literature about this, I think the estimates vary anywhere from maybe, oh, you're missing one out of three to you're missing one out of 10, and it can be higher. And it depends a lot on the situation. In New York City, it probably is a lot different than it is in Anchorage, or in Alaska, excuse me. And so what is unique about Alaska is that we have been able to do contact tracing on every single case that's been reported to the state health department. And that's not true in many locations in the United States and globally. And so we feel as though we probably have a better sense of our true incidence of disease based on our current numbers that we have had reported to us. But we still don't know what proportion have gone unreported. If I had to guess, I would guess it's somewhere on the order of maybe anywhere from 3 to 5 or 7-fold, but I don't think it's a whole lot higher than that. But who knows? And that's something that we could find out through serologic studies, epidemiologic studies down the road. But that's how I'd answer that question. Then, in terms of Wrangell, you know, let's say if we're missing 1 in 3 or 2 in 3. Then you just kind of have to do the math based on your population. So, Anne, would you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we're kind of trying to catch these nets. I was talking to the governor the other day, and we were talking about mosquitoes and how you try to set up all these nets, but they still get in. And I think we're trying to kind of set up all these ways to try to catch cases early so that we can just really box it in and make sure those people are supported and it doesn't spread rapidly. So that's the reason for, you know, a lot of the pre-symptomatic testing for hospital admission. That's part of the reason for the travel testing, kind of looking at those high risk areas and trying to catch cases earlier. And then Lisa, I had shared those slides. I don't know if this would be a good time if you want me to, and I can also share my screen, it's easier, but we just threw together a couple slides on the Wrangell specific area, including testing and cases. And so this you can get off of our Data Hub website, and there's actually a lot of data in there that you can download. So for the city and borough of a population of about 2,400, a combined test that we have kind of reported back to us. Again, this is all what's been finalized. There's 284 with a percent of the population tested of about 11%. Again, those aren't individual people necessarily. They may have been repeat tests for one person, and we don't have a good way to see that. But that's a little bit of data for your area, and you can compare to the rest of the area around the state. And then if you want to go to the next slide. There we go. So here's the testing by date and your location. And so it looks like you guys did a big kind of testing batch around the end of May there and kind of tapered down throughout June. But you can see the tests per day that we received. Again, these are when we receive the results back to our lab. That's how these come back to us. So they may have been done earlier. And then here is the acquisition of cases. And so the three cases, and they are always coded based on if it's travel, community, secondary, or under investigation. And so first being community, the next one secondary, and the June 16th under investigation. And oftentimes that's a kind of reporting lag and it just trying to make sure that we've got all the details related to that case. So you can actually go on our state website and toggle between all the different boroughs and check out everyone's different testing rates and location rates and type of cases. So just a few slides for there.
Hi, it's Dr. Brzanka here. I think I need to interject now.
Yeah, please.
Because what you're reporting is the number of tests that the state has run or that were reported to the state when the state was still collecting those. And we've been told very clearly that the state doesn't want our tests that are negative. So you've reported 200 to 300 tests. We've actually done over 1,000 tests. So that dynamic and what we're doing in the community significantly.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up. So we would like all positive and negative results to come back, but we don't need the Abbotts to be rerun at the state lab. So I think there's been some communication about that. But Joe, I don't know if you have anything else about that, but we would like all negative and positive as a...
Right, that's correct.
I think that can be a conversation offline, but that is most definitely not what we were told.
Okay, it's good to know. That's why we have these. It's a way to circle up and make sure we're all on the same page. So it's good to be learning as we go. So I really appreciate that feedback. And let's definitely touch base on that. That way we all have the same numbers.
Dr. Zink, this is Lisa again. Also, we have a fourth positive case. And I don't know if there's just a data lag there, but I was just going to ask a question related to that. And perhaps Dr. Prasanka can speak to that a little bit as well.
The difference in that data is that it's the difference between travel related out of state versus residents of Alaska.
Right. Okay. That's what I wanted to confirm for everybody. Thank you.
And we are working on some additional information on the website to kind of help display out of state a little bit better. You can see the cases and then you can go to a separate section and you can get it downloaded, but it isn't like super clear on there. For people's awareness, almost all, not all, but almost all of our out-of-state cases have been in the fishing industry, and they have been in quarantine when they have been detected. So the majority of the cases really have not had any or very minimal interaction, if any at all. And so the kind of risk to the community as a whole is much different if someone is in quarantine like that. So we get that question a lot. Well, isn't that the same? That's a very different case as a risk to the community than someone who is a community identified case. So just for your awareness, I'm part of the reason there's been that way. The CDC has us list Alaska residents. We get that asked all the time. We clearly take into account all of these people. Each one of them is a person. And if they're here in Alaska, it is a risk. But I will tell you the majority of out-of-state travelers are in quarantine, no community interaction, and are seafood.
Thank you very much for clarifying that. We're going to switch gears just a little bit here. We've got a number of questions related to people reporting out once people are, once there's a known positive. So the first is from Caleb Vierkant, who's the Wrangell Sentinel news reporter. Why exactly are the names of COVID-19 cases confidential? How can people know whether or not they've come into contact with a patient if they do not know who they are or where they have been?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. And Joe, I know that you have to go soon. I don't know if you want to throw anything in here and take off and I can finish up or...
Sure. Yeah, no, I can start. So we keep, so that's protected health information. There's federal laws as well as state laws that prohibit covered entities like the state health department, Department of Health and Social Services from relaying that protected health information to the public and to others without the specific consent of the individual.
So the HIPAA, Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, as well as state public health permitted disclosure laws. And so the way that people are informed if they've been in contact with a confirmed case is we do what's called contact tracing. So for every case that is identified, we call that person and we figure out when their infectious period was, the period when they were shedding virus and could be infectious to others. And then we work with that person to figure out who all they came in close contact with during that infectious period.
And so the other things that I'll just add to that, so we are a HIPAA compliant entity in the state. And the other thing too is stigma. We really want people to get tested and we wanna make sure we keep an eye on the cases. And we are already seeing in numerous communities where people say, I don't wanna get tested because I don't wanna be the first person in my community that would be identified as that. And I think it's important to remember that the goal is to keep the virus down. The big goal is healthy and well Alaskans. Like that is the overall goal. And one way to do that is to minimize being overrun by a brand new pandemic that's overrunning the world. And to do that, we have to identify cases. And if we can identify cases, then we can help, as Joe mentioned, figure out who else was in close contact. The other thing I would add is what's different about this virus compared to other ones like we talked about before is that pre-symptomatic shedding that can happen. And so just because Joe might have been identified as the person, that doesn't mean that Mary might not have more virus at this moment. And so, you know, from thinking about you as an individual and how to protect you as an individual or as a community, there isn't a ton of science to say, you know, let's look at the past person. It's kind of like looking at the flashlight where you're standing or behind you. You want to look where you're going. And so we just need to realize that other people may be infected. And that's why all of these mitigation strategies of distancing, of wearing a mask when in public or around other people, of hand washing is just so important because any one of us could be shedding virus right now and be at our peak symptomatic spread. And this is just a very humbling virus. Every single one of these case investigations, when you get into it, it's shocking on how mild the symptoms can be and then how sick they can get later. And how much, you know, people making the right decisions can miss this disease. So that's the other reason. It wouldn't necessarily help to shine the light backwards. It's good to look forwards.
Dr. Zink, I'm actually gonna break with our formatting here. Representative Ortez has indicated that he has a question. And so I'm actually going to let him ask that question directly.
Sounds great.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Zink, for the opportunity to have this meeting tonight for the community of Wrangell. Much appreciated. I have a question in relationship to the coming school year, both in Wrangell and, of course, in Ketchikan and the other schools that I represent. You know, we had the closure of the schools, and that kind of came down as a mandate from, the state level. With the recent spike that we've seen in the state of Alaska, are you thinking that direction will come from the state level in terms of what the status will be in for the schools in the fall? Or are the schools going to be pretty much left to make their own decisions?
I appreciate that question, Representative. I like to think that we're never any one of us left, that we're all in this together, regardless of the decision of what that happens. We have been working with Commissioner Johnson. And as I think you're probably aware, he created like a three-phase plan. So kind of green, yellow, and red. Green would be pretty much, you know, mitigation strategy. So hand washing, distancing, things like that. But that would happen if you really did not have any community transmission or very little community transmission. Yellow would be moderate community transmission of the disease. And red would be significant community transmission of the disease. What becomes really challenging in Alaska is like, what's a community? We all define our community slightly differently, and the mixing between populations, the seasonal flow of that, it can all make a difference between them. We have been struggling with this question as a state, as a nation, to try to help define this. I think we should use geography to our advantage in a lot of different ways. And so we're in the process with Dr. McLaughlin and his team in the EPI talking about how can we look at boroughs and census regions to kind of at least say, you've got minimal to moderate, you've got moderate disease, or you've got severe transmission disease, so that that could fit better into kind of the plans. We wanted to get school districts thinking about this as early as possible, just like after spring break. like Whispering Break, at that timing, we were starting to see a lot of cases in Europe, and there was a lot of questions if we should travel or not. And it, again, we weren't sure where this was all going to go. We were already stood up in our EOC, and we said, you know, let's just like have people pause for the 2 weeks right after spring break. And so we had that 2 week pause. And honestly, I think that, that may have been the biggest effect on our overall not having a ton of cases, is because we had so many people who had been traveling and they all had to do like a 2 week quarantine before they could start mixing to some degree, rather than all going into schools and mixing a ton and potentially really taking off in that area. But it was also to buy us some time to help try to figure out how do we continue schooling, because education is just fundamental to everything that we do in so many ways. And so to transition into that. And so learning from that experience, we really wanted school districts to start thinking now about, no matter what the fall looks like, they have a good plan on making sure kids are educated. Lots of disease, minimal, moderate. And so that's why we've kind of asked to go down those plan routes. But we're working closely with Dee to kind of help figure out, so that we can take on the health part and say, this is kind of the community-esque risk for your area. And then the communities and the schools really take on the education part and say, this is what this matters. So there's lots of conversation back and forth. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So if I'm hearing you correctly, there's the high, medium, and low risk category, and you will be assisting the different districts throughout the state as to determining which category they should view themselves. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're trying to figure out exactly what that would look like. It will probably be borough region. So this borough would be identified as a region, and to say kind of the transmission rate instead of a district. And we would definitely not be doing it on a school basis. Okay. However, there may be reasons why a certain school would have a very good reason to be very different. And that would be a conversation that could be had, you know, with the commissioner on exactly, well, we're in this borough, but no one ever comes in and out of our town, and we're totally separate, and we're only, you know, 10 kids on our school. That's a really different mitigation strategy than, you know, 3,000 kids in a high school playing sports together.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for the question.
Dr. Zink, we have a number of questions. I think many of them, a number of questions from our superintendent, school board, and community members regarding schools. I think many of them have been answered in the response to Representative Ortiz. But I just want to add maybe a couple of things. And one of those is from the superintendent. In our Smart Start meeting, some committee members wondered why the state does not come up with a generic restart plan for all school districts in Alaska. I think that's been answered here. But will you speak to the importance of districts coming up with their own plan, please?
Yeah, so really my world is health. And so that's in Commissioner Johnson's realm, is how he wants to work best with superintendents with their own plans. You definitely don't want me coming up with your superintendent plan for educating students. That is for sure. So we are here to support and assist in any way we possibly can from a health perspective. And so we have a meeting with Commissioner Johnson, and then we have a meeting with superintendents as well about what that looks like. That being said, the CDC has had a significant increase in kind of recommendations online, and I would encourage every parent, every teacher, every superintendent to take a look at them, because there's a lot of things in there to be able to consider what ways you can kind of mitigate the risk of the disease, and that's what we've been sharing with the superintendents. You know, nothing secret here. That's really what we've been pointing to. The only thing that where I would see us being more involved, besides kind of the basic CDC recommendations, is helping to define borough risk level, given our large geography and because we're looking more at those epidemiological cases.
Okay, switching back to a little bit of the health side of the school equation, the question from a community member is, will schools or parents be notified if a student or employee tests positive, or will that be dependent on self-reporting by the student or employee?
It's a great question, and we actually were working with Dee to come up on a communication tool, because I do think that this will come up. It came up even during the early phases of this pandemic, when we had no cases in the state, travel-related kids and concerns and rumors and all of that. Again, we seek to protect the individual person's identity. Clearly, if it's a minor, their parent would be notified. And usually this happens by their primary care provider, that the positive is there. We would not necessarily notify the school unless the kid had been in school or there had been some other exposure to school. So say, you know, this was the end of spring break or the end of Christmas break. We wouldn't, and the kid hadn't been in school in 2 weeks, we wouldn't necessarily say that kid. That being said, most kids will probably be in school most days. And so then we would be in communication with the school district itself and the principals to try to help identify who the cases are that may have been in close contact to that kid. And this is where we really do appreciate the public health nurses and the school nurses in cooperation and partnership. Because while, you know, Joey and Fred might be in the same classroom, you know, they might be hanging out with Susie a lot at, outside. And so identifying those close contacts sometimes takes more than just the kid's history. And be able to go from there.